Kant in 90 Minutes by Paul Strathern. Copyright 1996 by Paul Strathern. This unabridged recording of the reading of Kant in 90 Minutes was published by arrangement with Ivan R. D. and was produced in 2002 by Blackstone Audiobooks Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Neither this reading nor any portion of it may be reproduced or used for any purpose without prior written authorization from Blackstone Audiobooks. This book is read by Robert Whitfield. This book is 85 pages long. Kant in 90 Minutes. The following material appears on the book's back cover. Immanuel Kant taught and wrote prolifically about physical geography, yet never travelled farther than 40 miles from his home in Königsberg. How appropriate that in his philosophy he should deny that all knowledge was derived from experience. Kant's aim was to restore metaphysics. He insisted that all experience must conform to knowledge. According to Kant, space and time are subjective. Along with various categories, they help us to see the phenomena of the world, though never its true reality. In Kant in 90 Minutes, Paul Strathern offers a concise expert account of Kant's life and ideas, and explains their influence on man's struggle to understand his existence in the world. Introduction. Just because a thing is impossible, this doesn't mean someone won't try to do it. Kant not only tried, but succeeded in achieving the impossible. After Hume had destroyed philosophy and any possibility of constructing a metaphysical system, Kant created the greatest metaphysical system of them all. His motive was to refute Hume, but fortunately he had read only Hume's Inquiry into Human Understanding, not the more penetrating scepticism of his earlier Treatise of Human Nature. Had Kant read this, he might have produced no system. This would have been a great pity, and would have left an entire generation of 19th-century German philosophy professors without jobs. Kant's system is like Newton's idea of gravity. It's not the final answer, but it's close to how we still see the world. You won't go far wrong if you look at the world Kant's way. Hume's philosophy is essentially simplistic. It reduces our philosophical condition to the barren rock of solipsism. Kant, building on the deceptive sands of error, created a wonderful sandcastle of such ingenuity and complexity that it can keep you happily absorbed with your bucket and spade for your entire vacation. It's difficult to know what to say about Kant's life. He didn't really have one, outside his head. Nothing of any real interest happened to him. But the description of a life of utter tedium need not be boring in itself. Kant's life and works. Immanuel Kant was born April the 22nd, 1724, in the Baltic city of Königsberg, then the capital of the isolated German province of East Prussia, now Kaliningrad in Russia. Kant's ancestors had emigrated from Scotland in the preceding century, and may well have been related to the notorious 17th-century Scottish preacher Andrew Kant, who is said to have been the origin of the verb to cant with regard to the use of jargon, a family trait which was to reappear with a vengeance in the philosopher. At the time of Kant's birth, East Prussia was recovering from the devastation of war and plague, which had reduced the population by over half. Kant grew up in an atmosphere of pious poverty. He was the fourth child of the family, which eventually included five sisters and one other brother. Kant's Scottish father was a cutter of leather straps, who jocularly claimed that he could never make both ends meet, either at home or at work. Kant always remained respectful of his likable but financially harassed father, and as a child is said to have enjoyed watching him deftly cutting up pieces of leather for harnesses. Yet according to the philosopher-psychologist Ben-Amir Schaffstein, in the light of his father's dexterity, Kant's great clumsiness with his hands is therefore noteworthy. Whether or not this is the case, and what precisely it might be noteworthy of, the main early influence in Kant's life was undoubtedly his mother. Frau Kant was a wholly uneducated German woman who is said to have possessed great natural intelligence. It was this which particularly influenced her son Immanuel, or Manelchen, as she called him, little Manny. Kant's mother would take him for walks in the countryside and tell him the names of the plants and flowers. At night she would show him the stars, naming them and their constellations. She was a pious woman, and her loving but austere ways also helped shape her son's moral character. This dual insistence on facts and moral obligation was to remain with Kant throughout his life and played a leading role in his philosophy. Kant's most celebrated remark, made over 50 years later, harks directly back to these early days with his mother. "The starry heavens above and the moral law within fill the mind with an ever new and increasing admiration and awe, the more often and the more steadily we reflect." Kant was brought up in a strict pietist atmosphere, and from age 8 until 16 went to the local pietist school. Here his exceptional intelligence and keen thirst for learning quickly grew irked with the endless religious instruction. This dislike of formal religion was to remain with him for the rest of his days. In mature life he never attended church. Despite this, Kant retained much of the pietist outlook, with its belief in a simple way of life and adherence to strict morality. In 1737, Kant's mother died and received a pauper's burial. Kant was 13 at the time, and has indicated that he experienced his first sexual stirrings around this period. Psychologists have suggested that the loss of his beloved mother at this stage of puberty caused him to feel guilty and repress his sexual feelings. Either this, or they simply withered away. Whatever the cause, from now on Kant was to live a life of sexual repression which assumed heroic proportions. At the age of 18, Kant was admitted to the University of Königsberg as a theological student. Initially, he was given financial assistance by the local pietist church, but he also helped to support himself by tutoring some of his more backward colleagues. He soon grew bored with theology and began showing a strong interest in mathematics and physics. He read Newton, who opened his eyes to science and the great advances being made in all parts of it, from astronomy to zoology. Science based on experiment could only be accommodated in an empiricist philosophy, that is, one which bases our knowledge of the world on experience. In 1746, when Kant was 22, his father died. Kant and his 5 younger sisters were left penniless. The younger of these sisters were taken in by a pietist family, while the older ones went to work as chambermaids. Kant applied unsuccessfully for a job at a local school, and was forced to leave the university without taking a degree. For the next 9 years, Kant supported himself as a tutor to wealthy families in the surrounding countryside. For a while he was employed by the Count and Countess Kaiserling, the aristocratic family which was later to produce the pseudo-philosopher Hermann Kaiserling, whose uplifting but bogus ideas were to prove such a comfort to disillusioned society matrons after World War I. Whenever Kant had a little extra cash, he would send some of it to his less fortunate sisters, a habit he continued throughout his later life. His 5 sisters were to continue living in Königsberg, a city with just 50,000 inhabitants, throughout the whole of Kant's life. Yet he saw none of them for over 25 years. When one of his sisters finally came to visit him, he did not even recognize her. After it was explained to him who she was, he apologized to the rest of the company for her lack of culture. Kant may not have been a social snob, but he was renowned for his inability to tolerate fools, even in his own family, it would seem. Yet this incident raises a curious point. Kant's sister must surely have borne more than a passing resemblance to their mother, both intellectually and physically. She would even have been around the same age as Kant's mother when she brought him up. Does this mean that Kant's celebrated love for his mother had become so deep that he no longer recognized it? Suggestion has been made that Kant unconsciously resented the repressive nexus, facts, morality, sexual extinction, imposed on him by his mother. His inability to recognize his sister, or indeed have anything to do with her, may well have followed from this, but we have no way of knowing. Kant's sheer lack of life has perversely attracted far more attention from psychologists than the comparatively normal life lived by other philosophers. Kant may have been indifferent toward his own family, but he appears to have enjoyed life among the rich families where he was employed as a tutor. His appearance was as much an oddity as his character. He was less than 5 feet tall, and his head was disproportionately large for his body. His frame suffered from a slight corkscrew twist, which made his left shoulder droop, his right shoulder curve back, and his head tend to lean to one side. Dressed in threadbare clothes, and with scarcely a pfennig to his name, he had not exactly been the hit of the campus at the University of Königsberg, which was itself hardly a centre of cosmopolitan society. But now, decked out by his employers in his elegant tutor's outfit, and encouraged to mingle with family guests, Kant positively blossomed. He soon developed a ready wit, acquired a veneer of sophisticated assurance, and became a mean hand at the card and billiard tables. When the families departed for their summer vacations in the country, Kant accompanied them, sometimes journeying almost 40 miles from Königsberg. This was the farthest he was ever to travel from his provincial home city throughout his life. But this period of comparative elegance was only a phase. In 1755, at the age of 31, Kant was at last able to take his degree at the University of Königsberg, partly owing to the charity of a pietist benefactor. This was late to be finishing a degree, and as we shall see, Kant was an unusually late developer. By this age, almost all the other major philosophers had already begun formulating the ideas for which they would be remembered. Not until 2 decades later did Kant really begin to produce original philosophy. Kant was now able to take up a post at the university as a Privatdozent, junior lecturer. This post he held for the next 15 years, living a bachelor academic existence of unremitting industry. During this time he lectured mainly on mathematics and physics, and published treatises on a wide range of scientific subjects. These included volcanoes, the nature of winds, anthropology, the cause of earthquakes, fire, the aging of the earth, even the planets, which he predicted would all one day be inhabited, those farthest from the sun developing the species with the highest intelligence. Yet Kant's natural bent was toward speculation. He continued to read widely in philosophy. In rationalistic philosophy, his ideas were most influenced by Newton and Leibniz. Newton's greatest achievements may have been in physics and mathematics, but in those days these subjects were still considered part of philosophy, as natural philosophy. The full title of Newton's greatest work is Philosophiae Naturalis Principia Mathematica, The Mathematical Principles of Natural Philosophy. Kant studied Newton with sufficient thoroughness to propose a new theory of motion and rest, which opposed Newton's view. The fact that he had misunderstood Newton is not the point. He was being led to speculate on systems which encompassed the universe, and was willing to question the greatest intellect of the era on his own ground. According to Leibniz, the physical world of cause and effect proved the inner harmony of the world's moral purpose. Reading Leibniz led Kant to see humanity as not only participating in nature, but over and above this, participating in the ultimate purpose of the universe. At the same time, Kant's interest in the philosophy of science led him to read the Scottish philosopher Hume. Kant was impressed by Hume's insistence on experience as the basis of all knowledge. This squared with a scientific approach. But Kant found himself unable to accept the sceptical conclusions that Hume drew from his rigid empiricism. According to Hume, all we experience is a sequence of perceptions. And this means that such notions as cause and effect, bodies and things, even the controlling hand of God the Creator, are all mere suppositions or beliefs. None of them is ever actually experienced. Surprisingly, Kant was also struck by the emotional appeal of Rousseau. The first of the Romantics, Rousseau was the most unacademic of all philosophers, believing in personal expression through emotion more than rational thought. His advocacy of liberty was to prove a heady inspiration for the French Revolution. Kant may have been an essentially dry character, but there was something in Rousseau that touched a chord in his deeply suppressed emotions. Beneath the facade of the prim academic beat the heart of a closet romantic, and this was later to become apparent in his philosophy. But for the time being, all these disparate elements, Newton, Leibniz, Hume, Rousseau, remained just that. Not until Kant found a way of reconciling and absorbing these influences would he be able to produce original philosophy, and the enormity of such a task would take a long time. Perhaps Kant became impatient, for there now occurred an odd episode. Instead of publishing another serious academic work, Kant wrote a curious satirical book called Dreams of a Ghost-Seer Elucidated by Means of Metaphysical Dreams. The ghost-seer of the title is the Swedish visionary mystic Swedenborg, famous for his descriptions of his lengthy travels through heaven and hell. In 1756, Swedenborg had published his 8-volume masterwork Arcana Coelestia, The Secrets of Heaven. Unfortunately, sales did not go well, and after 10 years only 4 copies had been sold. One of these is now known to have been bought by Kant. These volumes of metaphysical mumbo-jumbo had a profound effect on Kant, enough to inspire him to write an entire book satirizing them. As Kant whimsically declares in his introduction, "The author confesses with a certain humility that he was so simple-minded as to track down the truth of some tales of the sort mentioned. He found, as usual, where one has nothing to look for, he found nothing." Yet it soon became evident that Kant's mockery of the worst visionary of them all, and of sundry airy thought-worlds hewn out of fraudulent concepts, is not quite what it seems. Beneath his consistent raillery and expressions of intellectual contempt is an unmistakable element of profoundly serious interest in Swedenborg. Kant longed to believe in metaphysics, even if not in quite such an extreme form, but his formidable intellectual development was beginning to close down this avenue. Kant's writing style is notoriously prolix and difficult, but by all accounts his lectures were quite the opposite. His body was so short and twisted that only his bewigged head with its prim, precise features was visible above the lectern. But this talking head was a font of wit, fascinating erudition and ideas. Kant's lectures were a great hit, and his fame soon spread, encouraged by his stream of treatises on scientific subjects. His celebrated summer lectures on geography always attracted crowds from outside the university. These continued for over 30 years and established Kant as the first academic teacher of physical geography, despite the fact that throughout his life he never set eyes on a mountain and may never even have seen the open sea, which was almost 20 miles away. Kant's vivid and perceptive descriptions brought to life the wonders of the distant lands that he read about with such enthusiasm during the long winter evenings, when the freezing Baltic fog drifted in through the streets of remote provincial Königsberg. Kant now also began delivering lectures on philosophy. And here it soon became apparent that he had journeyed far and wide through the hostile territories of ethics and epistemology, beyond the ultima thule of logic, and even into regions so remote from civilization as metaphysics, and had lived to tell the tale. Meanwhile, treatises on more amenable subjects, such as fireworks, military defense, and the theory of the heavens, continued to pour from his pen. Despite this, Kant was twice refused a professorship at the University of Königsberg. The reasons for this are unclear, but one suspects an element of provincial snobbery. Or perhaps they just didn't like him. Either way, Kant certainly liked Königsberg. When he was offered the prestigious post of professor of poetry at the University of Berlin, he turned it down. Fortunately, in 1770, the Königsberg University authorities relented, and Kant was appointed Professor of Logic and Metaphysics. Now, at age 46, he had grown increasingly critical of Leibniz and his rationalistic disciples, who had become the dominant force in German philosophy. Hume's empiricism seemed undeniable, and reluctantly Kant even became convinced by Hume's skepticism. objects, cause and effect, continuity, even the self, all these appeared to be fallacious notions. They remained beyond the reach of our experience, which was the only certain source of our knowledge. Kant accepted this because it seemed to him intellectually irrefutable. But he was not happy with this barren state of affairs. There appeared to be no further room for philosophy to continue. Was this really the end? Then, one day, while studying Hume's Inquiry Concerning Human Understanding, Kant awoke from his dogmatic slumbers. In a flash of inspiration, he saw how he could construct a system and answer the destructive scepticism of Hume which had threatened to destroy metaphysics forever. For 11 years, Kant published nothing, but continued working out his philosophy. Already he had begun living a life of extreme regularity, and during this period his routine began to achieve legendary status. In the words of Heine, "Rising, coffee-drinking, writing, lecturing, dining, walking, each had its set time. And when Immanuel Kant, in his grey coat, cane in hand, appeared at the door of his house and strolled towards the small avenue of linden trees, which is still called the Philosopher's Walk, the neighbours knew that it was exactly 3:30 by the clock. So he promenaded up and down during all seasons, and when the weather was gloomy or the grey clouds threatened rain, his old servant, Lampa, was to be seen plodding anxiously after, with a large umbrella under his arm, like a symbol of prudence." Only on one famous occasion is Kant said to have broken this routine, on the day he started reading Rousseau's Émile, when he became so absorbed that he missed his walk in order to finish it. Only Rousseau's avowal of romantic emotion could make him forget his routine. But such feelings were not enough to cause any serious break with the habits of a lifetime. Although Kant twice considered marriage during these years, on both occasions he took so long making up his mind that by the time he'd decided, in favour on both occasions, one of the ladies had married someone else and the other had moved to another city. Kant was not a man to be rushed into decisions. Yet his admiration for Rousseau's romantic ideas was not confined to theory. Years later, when many of Rousseau's ideas came to fruition with the outbreak of the French Revolution, Kant wept with joy, a rare sentiment in the fiercely conservative provincial Prussian city of Königsberg, and probably unique among its university establishment. In 1781, Kant at last published his Critique of Pure Reason, generally regarded as his masterpiece. Yet not all his readers were enthusiastic. When Kant sent a copy of the manuscript to his friend Hertz, it was eventually returned only half-read. Hertz claimed that to continue reading Kant's work any further would have been to court insanity. And you may well feel the same. In his Critique of Pure Reason, Kant decided to dispense with many interesting arguments and concrete examples, for fear of making his work too long. Even so, in the translated version it runs to over 800 pages, and most of it is like this. "The apodictical proposition cogitates the assertorical as determined by these very laws of the understanding, constantly affirming as a priori, and in this manner it expresses..." Even in the finest translation it only sounds better. "La proposizione apodittica concepisce il guidizio assertorio determinato secondo queste leghe dell'intelletto stressoe, per conseguenza, come affermativo a priori, ed esprime così..." You don't want to know what it's like in German. The miracle is that Hertz managed to get as far as halfway before fearing for his sanity. But don't let this distract you from the magnificence of Kant's actual system. Kant's aim was to restore metaphysics. He agreed with Hume and the empiricists that there are no such things as innate ideas, but he denied that all knowledge was derived from experience. The empiricists argue that all knowledge must conform to experience. Kant brilliantly reversed this by saying that all experience must conform to knowledge. According to Kant, space and time are subjective. They are our way of perceiving the world. In a way, they are like irremovable spectacles, without which we are incapable of making sense of our experience. But these are not the only subjective elements that help us understand our experience. Kant explained that there are various categories, as he called them, which we conceive of by means of our understanding working independently of experience. These categories include such things as quality, quantity, and relation. These two are like irremovable spectacles. We cannot see the world in any other way than in terms of quality, quantity, and so forth. But through these irremovable spectacles we can see only the phenomena of the world. We can never perceive the actual noumena, the true reality that supports or gives rise to these phenomena. It has been observed that only a man who has never seen a mountain could possibly believe that space is not there outside us, only part of our perceptual apparatus. And common sense would seem to agree with this. But such gauche ad hominem objections have nothing to do with philosophy. Space and time, and the categories, which include such notions as plurality, causality, and existence, can only be applied to the phenomena of our experience. If we apply them to things which are not experienced, we end up with antinomies, that is, contrasting statements, both of which can apparently be proved by purely intellectual argument. In this way, Kant demolishes all purely intellectual arguments for the existence or non-existence of God. We simply cannot apply such a category as existence to such a non-empirical entity. As we can see, Kant was not in favour of a wholesale return to metaphysics in his Critique of Pure Reason. By pure reason, Kant here means a priori reason, something that can be known prior to experience. Hume had denied such transcendental entities, ones that transcend experience. But Kant was convinced that he had restored this transcendental, metaphysical element to philosophy in the form of his categories of pure reason. Hume's sceptical view may seem simplistic, and is certainly unworkable if we wish to live in the real world. His denial of causality effectively reduces the whole of science to the status of metaphysics. Kant's view, on the other hand, is immensely subtle and sophisticated, but it scarcely overcomes Hume's point from a philosophical point of view. We may not be able to experience the world without conceiving of space, quantity, and so forth, but it is difficult to argue that these are not an integral part of that experience, or to see how they could exist without it, that is, prior to it. On the other hand, Kant's argument that we can never know the real world carries considerable weight. All the things we perceive are only phenomena. The thing in itself, the noumena, which supports or gives rise to these phenomena, remains forever unknowable, and there is no reason why it should resemble in any way our perceptions. The phenomena are perceived by way of our categories, which have nothing whatsoever to do with the thing in itself. This remains beyond quality, quantity, relation, and the like. After publishing the Critique, Kant continued to live his life of rigid routine. This did not preclude an element of socializing, though this was always very much a minor element in his life. He maintained relations with a number of his brighter students, as well as a few members of the faculty, yet he was never close with any of them. No one was addressed with the informal du, even after decades of social contact. Thought was his life. For a scholar, thinking is a means of nourishment, without which, when he is awake or alone, he cannot live. He was more intent on knowing himself than anyone else. But the task of getting to know Kant proved as difficult for himself as it was for others. "I do not understand myself sufficiently," he complained. Perhaps he was afraid of what he might find. Here Scharfstein makes a fundamental point. This thing in itself was not simply unknown, it was forbidden, for it was Kant's suppressed emotional life, I take it, and he was afraid that if it was revealed, he would be devastated. Kant was well aware that he had no friends, but this didn't bother him. He was fond of quoting Aristotle's remark, "My friends, I have no friends." Indeed, he positively recommended this state. Friendship is a restriction of favourable sentiments to a single subject, and is very pleasing to him towards whom they are directed, but also a proof that generality and goodwill are lacking. Psychologists have claimed that Kant's inability or unwillingness to form close relationships indicated a profound unhappiness. But Kant does not appear to have been unhappy, quite the opposite. Those who met him remarked on his cheerfulness. Kant's disposition was by nature meant for cheerfulness. He saw the world with a glad look and transferred his cheerfulness to external things. Therefore he was usually disposed to be happy, was a typical observation by one of his colleagues. 7 years after the publication of his Critique of Pure Reason, Kant published his Critique of Practical Reason. Shorter than its predecessor, it makes no other concessions to the reader. When I came across the first edition owned by Coleridge, an ardent fan of Kant, I couldn't help noticing that some of the pages were still uncut. In this work, Kant reinstated God, who was no longer deemed unspeakable because he didn't fit into the categories. The Critique of Practical Reason is devoted to the ethical part of Kant's system. Here, instead of seeking metaphysical grounds for our perception, he seeks them for our morality. Kant was searching for nothing less than the fundamental moral law. But surely it was impossible to discover such a law that would please everyone. From Christians to Buddhists, from liberals to Prussians, all believing in the same fundamental good? Kant believed it was possible to discover a basic law, but he did so by sidestepping what most would consider to be the main question. Good and evil were not his concern here. He was not seeking to discover some essence of all the different interpretations of these basic moral concepts. Kant stressed that he was seeking the grounds of morality rather than its content. As with pure reason, so with practical reason. What was needed was a set of a priori principles like the categories. In fact, Kant eventually came up with only one principle, his categorical imperative. This was the a priori ground for all moral action, its metaphysical premise. In an analogous way to the categories of pure reason, this gives a framework to our ethical thinking, practical reason, though without giving it any specific moral content. Kant's categorical imperative states, "Act only in accord with a principle which you would at the same time will to be a universal law." This principle led Kant to believe that we should act in accordance with our duty, not according to our feelings, and resulted in some odd conclusions. For instance, Kant stated that the moral worth of an action should not be judged according to its consequences, but only in so far as it was done for the sake of duty. This is plainly daft, if morality is to do with society rather than just individual self-righteousness. Kant intended his categorical imperative as a mere framework, empty of moral content, but it isn't quite. It still contains traces of moral content, the morality of conformity, for a start. Kant's categorical imperative implies that everyone should act in precisely the same way, regardless of temperament or task. Should the head of a government act with the same moral scruples as the head of a monastery? Should he even try? Should Churchill have tried to behave like Gandhi, or vice versa? Perhaps all systems are bound to lead to such rigidities. But without any ethical system we would be completely lost, unable to make any value judgments whatsoever. Kant's ethical system also led him to believe that we should never tell a lie, regardless of what consequences this might involve. He was well aware of the implications of this argument, but he stuck to it nonetheless. To tell a falsehood to a murderer who is in pursuit of a friend of yours who has taken refuge in your house would be a crime. Are we to believe that Kant would have delivered a Jewish friend to Nazis? No. Everything we know about him suggests that he would have followed the dictates of duty here. His highly active mind would quickly have discovered a duty which forbade him to hand over his friend. Yet this question of never telling a lie exposes a distinct flaw in Kant's system. For make no mistake about it, Kant took this business about lies extremely seriously. He even spent time agonizing over the question of whether it was permissible to end a letter with the customary greeting of the period, "Your obedient servant." Was this a lie? Kant insisted he was no man's servant, that he had no intention of obeying his correspondence, but eventually he seems to have relented on this matter. Yet on more serious literary matters he remained unbending. He was against the reading of novels. They caused our thought to become fragmentary and weakened our memory. for it would be ridiculous to memorize novels in order to relate them to others. The implication that Kant memorized all other books he read is not to be lightly dismissed. Here Kant overlooks the fact that reading Rousseau's novel Héloïse was a formative experience, which he seems to have accomplished without exploding his thoughts into fragments or softening his memory. Kant enjoyed reading poetry, but only if it was an intellectual harmonization of virtue and sentiment. Unrhymed poetry was simply prose gone mad. Music was a different and altogether more difficult matter. Music alone could penetrate the carapace of repression that protected his unexpressed emotions, and in consequence he was particularly harsh on it. He detested folk music, such as his mother had often sung to him. Musicians were characterless because what they played reduced everything to feeling. He recommended that his students avoid listening to music because it would make them effeminate. Yet he couldn't stop attending concerts himself, until the day he attended one in memory of the philosopher Moses Mendelssohn. This struck him as nothing less than endless moaning, and he never attended a concert again. In 1790, at the age of 58, Kant published the third and final part of his monsterpiece, his Critique of Judgment. This is ostensibly concerned with aesthetic judgments, but also with theology, and much, much more. Kant argues that the existence of art presupposes the artist, and that it is through the beauty of the world that we recognize a benign creator. As he had previously implied, we recognize God's work in the stars of the heavens as well as in our inner inclination to do good. As with his theory of perception and his ethical theory, Kant sought to establish a metaphysical basis for his theory of aesthetic judgment. He wished to establish an a priori principle that made our apprehension of beauty possible. Here Kant was on rather more shaky ground. It's always difficult to get a consensus on beauty. Some consider the Swiss Alps pure chocolate candy, finding spiritual sustenance in expressionism. Others do not. Such views are seemingly irreconcilable, but Kant was determined to bring everything within the bounds of his system. Kant argues, a person who describes something as beautiful insists that everyone ought to give the object in question his approval. The similarity to the categorical imperative is evident, but here it simply doesn't work, except in the personal pejorative sense. Once again we are faced with the conformity syndrome. Just because I find Francis Bacon's picture of a screaming pope beautiful doesn't mean I expect everyone else to do so. Kant goes on to argue that it is only through the unity and consistency of nature that science is possible. This unity cannot be proved, but must be assumed. Related to this idea is the notion that nature is purposive. Kant claims the purposiveness of nature is a special a priori concept. As we now know, this concept is not necessary to an assumption of the unity and consistency of nature, and even the latter are now questioned by quantum theory. Kant insisted that although we cannot prove the world has a purpose, we must look upon it as if it has a purpose. Kant didn't deny the evil, ugly, and apparently purposeless aspects of the world, but he thought they counted for a lot less than their more uplifting opposites. In the next century, Schopenhauer was to take precisely the opposite point of view, with perhaps more justification. In the end, neither the optimistic nor the pessimistic point of view can in any way be endorsed by proof, and remain ultimately a matter of temperament. Meanwhile, Kant continued with his indefatigable routine, and the citizens of Königsberg continued to set their watches according to when Kant began his afternoon walk. 3 p.m. precisely. Kant's view that time is all in the mind and has nothing to do with reality may have had something to do with his living in East Prussia. This territory was surrounded to the south and the west by Poland, which lived 1 hour ahead of East Prussia, and over the eastern border was Russia, which by its Julian calendar was 11 days behind the rest of Europe. The nearest people who kept the same time as East Prussia were 2 borders away, across Poland to the west in Germany. Kant lived on Prinzessinenstrasse, in a house that was demolished in 1893. Here he was looked after by his grumpy old servant Lamper, with whom he was capable of being equally grumpy. Everything had to be done exactly right. Lumpy even had to help his master out of his clothes each night in the correct order, and when Cant went to bed, he invariably wore one nightcap in summer and two in winter, which could be very cold indeed in Königsberg, when the nearby Baltic froze over. In the manner of all persnickety domestic tyrants, Cant was always concerned about Lumpy's spiritual welfare. Indeed, Kant declared that he had reinstated God in his Critique of Practical Reason expressly in order to give Lampe something to believe in. Lampe may not have fully appreciated this. We have no evidence of his gratitude. It's a little easier to guess Lampe's attitude toward his master's unique philosophical method of holding up his stockings. By means of pieces of string which ran up through his trouser pockets and were attached to springs contained in two small boxes. This last piece of information sounds utterly preposterous, but is confirmed by a number of independent sources, one of whom suggests that Kant's father being in the strap-making business had something to do with it. Like many possessed of an independent and imaginative mind, Kant was a practicing hypochondriac. Indeed, he was so good at it that he was the only person who ever noticed anything wrong with him. Throughout his long life, this frail little man with a twisted frame was never known to be ill. His hypochondria involved him in a tireless and systematic regime. One of his habits was to breathe only through his nose, especially when he went on his walk in cold weather. This meant that during autumn, winter, and spring, he was incapable of replying to anyone who addressed him on the street, because he refused to open his mouth in case he might catch a cold. Kant was fortunate while publishing his three great critiques. During this period, the political situation in Prussia was unusually tolerant, not a quality often associated with that country. It is doubtful that Kant would have been able to publish such works in most other European countries. He appreciated this and dedicated the Critique of Pure Reason to Zedlitz, Frederick the Great's Minister of Education. As befits a dry-as-dust provincial professor, Kant was outwardly respectful toward the king. But at heart he was surprisingly revolutionary, and he had nothing but contempt for the French philosophers who hung around Frederick's court. When Frederick the Great died in 1786, and Frederick William II ascended to the throne, Kant found himself in hot water. Wüllner, an ardent pietist, became the minister responsible for education, and charged Kant with misusing his philosophy to distort the Bible. Someone at the ministry had evidently managed to struggle through the 800 pages of the Critique of Pure Reason, and had discovered that it denied all proofs of the existence of God. Kant was required to pledge that he would not lecture or write further books on a religious subject. He wrote a letter to the king, giving his word that he would obey this order. But when the king died in 1797, Kant considered that he was released from his promise, and returned to the subject with renewed vigour. As we see here, Kant's views on lying were susceptible to adaptation when the occasion arose. By now Kant was approaching 70. Years of practice had perfected his hypochondria to the point where he was a master of this art. Each month he would send to the Königsberg chief of police for the latest mortality statistics, and from these he would calculate his own life expectancy. He became convinced that constipation clouded his brain, and he added an impressive array of laxatives to his laboratory-sized medicine chest. Avidly he would read through the journals describing the latest medical discoveries to determine whether he had any new diseases. Alarmed colleagues who attempted to dissuade him from this hobby were quickly put in their place. Kant knew far more about illness than any mere professor of medicine at the University of Königsberg. On this topic, as on all others, he could not tolerate contradiction. Unlike other similarly afflicted egoists, he was invariably right, and he knew it.
This book is continued on Disc 2.